A Weekend with Jason Dacey replay from Money FM 89.3.
Saving All My Love For You by Whitney Houston here on Money FM 89.3 with Neil Humphreys. And Whitney is the subject of our pop culture segment, Neil. And it's sad that Whitney left us a few years ago, but her music lives on in fantastic style. You know, when I think about Whitney Houston, I don't think about the US. I don't think about Australia where I was born. I don't think about Singapore. I think about living in London in the late 1980s, 1987, 1988, when Whitney, her second studio album came out.
Don't tell me she was your neighbor, because everybody's your neighbor.
Believe it or not, unlike Phil Collins, wasn't my neighbor, but, you know, I Want to Dance with Somebody, Didn't We Almost Have It All, So Emotional, Where Do Broken Hearts Go?
Yeah.
It was that year. I was working at the BBC, and I remember going to parties and you know, gatherings in that late 87, 88 period, and Whitney was all over the radio. It was Terence Trent D'Arby.
That's right.
It was Rick Astley.
Yes.
It was In Excess, and it was Whitney Houston with that album. And to me, that was her peak. That was her prime. And she was about, I guess, early to mid-20s at that point. She'd been around for a while, but she really established herself as a mega star at that time, didn't she? And it was a song after song after song, and you could dance to it. It was soulful. You know, there was great lyrics. Obviously, her vocal range was incredible.
The best.
But what a tragic life she had.
It was. I mean, just then I'm thinking about what you're saying. I had my first kiss when Whitney Houston was around with her, I Want to Dance with Somebody.
Is that right?
It makes me think, I was 25. No, it makes me think of a caravan site, working class holiday of the youth of Britain, a caravan site in Essex. Whitney Houston was, as you correctly say, just playing on a loop, you know, in the clubhouses.
Yeah.
So it was around the time of I Want to Dance with Somebody. And this girl and me, and we was about 11 years old.
Yes, I've been about 11 years old.
And we said, let's go out of the clubhouse to the playground, have a kiss. But there were people around. So the only place we could find was there was a slatted wooden fence that separated the men's toilets from the girls' toilets. So, and there was a hole in the fence. So my first romantic kiss to Whitney Houston's I Want to Dance with Somebody is me on tiptoes over the men's urinal, right?
Wow.
Where there was a hole in the fence above the urinal so I could go through and kiss her, and she was standing on the other side in the girls' toilets.
I hope she was tall.
Well, she was tall. I hope she washed her hands. But so that was my first kiss. But to...
That's quite a memory, but it's incredible how we associate artists and songs with times. And mine was also UK.
Because what I was going to say was, to bring it full circle, the first movie I ever went, my first date with my now wife in 1992 was The Bodyguard.
Wow. Yeah.
The Kevin Costner, Whitney Houston film, you know, I Will Always Love You, I Have Nothing, all those great hits. So Whitney Houston has as probably most people, has a major part in my life that I never thought about until we discussed we were going to do this. It's an extraordinarily tragic life because two big documentaries have come out on her. One is on Netflix, one will be shortly. And it's fascinating because she grew up in a musical family. Her mother, Cissy Houston, was a top backing singer with everybody, like Luther Vandross, all of the greats, and so on and so on. Dionne Warwick is her relative. Dee Dee Warwick, Dionne Warwick's sister, was her aunt. Dionne Warwick was her aunt. So she was born in this musical family, but her father was an unbelievable adulterer, had loads of affairs.
Yep.
And her mother had an affair with the church minister and the church where she learned to sing. So she had this idea that the church was pure and, you know, and a mother sleeping with the church minister. So she had a strange situation. Then at 18, she left home, Jason, and moved in with her best friend, Robin Crawford, who pops up a lot in her history. She's this kind of enigmatic figure in every documentary, every clip. This Robin is there, who was her assistant, her right-hand woman, and let's be honest, her lover for most of her career. That's public knowledge.
Yep.
But to be, well, let's get it right. To be a female celebrity and to be bisexual was unthinkable. But to be an African-American bisexual celebrity just could not, would not, can never happen.
Yeah.
So she had a very difficult upbringing, difficult life, difficult issues with her sexuality.
But what about this marriage with Bobby Brown?
Well, this is the thing. this is where her life becomes, it's a Shakespearean tragedy, because she has all of these hits with the pop Svengali, Clive Davis.
Yeah.
He writes all, or gets all these hits. She gets booed, Jason, at the Soul Train Awards, which is the big black African-American music event. She gets booed because they think she's too white.
Right.
Her music is not black enough.
Well, it had
she's
this appeal, didn't it? It was such a broad appeal.
It was cross appeal, yeah. It crossed over. Because it was, if you see the video, she's got brown hair, dyed her hair, she wears wigs. She almost looks... you know, mixed race. She isn't, but so she's playing clearly to a white audience and it works. So the black audience turn against her. She gets booed at the awards, and this is the Shakespearean tragedy. At that night where she gets booed, where her career thinks, I got my own people hating me, she meets Bobby Brown.
Oh dear, and that was the worst decision that
she
made.
Who is not by my, by other people. She's like Mr. Ghetto, Mr. Black Ghetto.
Yeah.
He wasn't, but he played up on that, you know.
Yeah.
So he tried to get... He needed her because she was much more talented than she was.
Much bigger star.
She felt like she needed him because she'd lost credibility with the African-American community, and it was always going to end in disaster. This idea that he got her onto drugs is not true.
Is that
her
right?
Her brother used to supply her with cocaine regularly when she was a teenager, Jason. She was a drug addict when she was a teenager.
See, I didn't know that. I always thought that she kind of deteriorated later on because she seemed so wholesome and so together in that 80s period that we talk about.
The whole family were drug addicts, and her brother was a drug dealer, really, and was supplying all of the siblings, big, large family, drugs in the 80s. But before you get to that, I mean, there's one transcendent moment that I would, you know, ask all listeners to watch. 1991. She sings the Star Spangled Banner. I think it's at the Super Bowl event. It's a big American football event.
Yep.
And it's just before the first Gulf War. And it is extraordinary because she sang it at a different speed. She slowed it down. She did it in one take. Everybody said it would flop. Everybody said it was too slow. Everybody said it was too boring. And African Americans have a bit of an issue with the Star Spangled Banner because it was about oppression and captivity, and there's the slave element
to it. And we're seeing NFL players taking the knee.
Correct.
And taking the knee, as they say, kneeling, which President Donald Trump has slammed. But they see it as a way of demonstrating against police brutality and many issues.
That's absolutely right. And they say that that single performance of the Star Spangled Banner in 1991 allowed African Americans to accept that song as theirs, the way she sang it, the way she emphasized certain elements of freedom and the song. And now, during 9/11, during major events, it is still played and still seen and heard as the definitive version of the Star Spangled Banner. And honestly, Jason, it brings tears to your eyes. Her vocal range is just off the charts. It's such a talent. And you watch it and you think, what a tragedy. That voice, that talent, and to such a premature end. It's so sad.
Yeah, I mean, she died in February 2012, found unresponsive, submerged in a bathtub at the Beverly Hilton Hotel Suite 434. And, you know, it was really sad that her
daughter died
as well. I was going to say that as well. It's so tragic. And results revealed that additional drugs in her system, including cannabis and Benadryl, Flexiri, and many of these very, very powerful drugs. I think cocaine as well was very great amount too. So it's incredible that she died, you know, such a relatively young age.
And had such a packed life.
Yeah,
I mean, such a traumatic life. Do you know, I mean, I was just reading Al Sharpton, you know, the famous African-American activist. He actually dubbed her Whitey Houston.
Wow.
Now, can you imagine what that must do to a young girl's psyche? She's got something like 7 number ones on the Billboard charts in the US, which I think at that time was a record. She's on, everybody supposedly loves her, but she's booed by her own people. Her siblings are giving her cocaine. You've got a prominent black activist calling her Whitey Houston. But the white community still see her as black because she is black. So she's never quite fitted in anywhere. She's in the closet about her sexuality. So that she's
so
never
many issues.
Been able to be the real Whitney Houston. And it's just such a sad way because she was born with this unbelievable God-given talent. Everybody, and I mean everybody, from Adele to you know, anybody who's anybody today, Beyonce, they all look at her. She is the one. She is their goddess of music. Because nobody, and I mean nobody, could sing like Whitney Houston. She had a vocal range that's untouchable.
Oh, incredible. Incredible singer. And you mentioned The Bodyguard. That was the first movie that you went to with your now wife in 1992. I went to that movie with my mum in 1992 on the Gold Coast. I was in the the Gold Coast in Australia, on the Queensland. In fact, I think I went on the New South Wales side, Tweed Heads, just south of the Coolangatta-Queensland border. I remember going with my mum. But I remember that movie made a big impression on me because Kevin Costner at the time was a massive star because of Dances with Wolves and other
films. And deserves credit for casting her because they wanted a white actress.
Exactly. But the film, it just seemed like it was the perfect role for her. She didn't have to act.
And she's good in it.
And she's
I think she was Oscar nominated for it. She certainly won Oscars for the song.
It was a brilliant brilliant performance, and she was quite new to acting at that level anyway.
Yeah, and the thing about that song, Kevin Costner claims he takes credit. He produced the film. He was behind the soundtrack. If you remember the song I Will Always Love You, I get goosebumps thinking about it. It's a Dolly Parton song, obviously, originally.
Yeah.
But the Dolly Parton version starts with a musical accompaniment straight away. But if you think of the Whitney Houston version, I think the first verse is just her a cappella.
Yes.
It's just, if I And they said, you can't do that. It's too dreary. Mm. It's too slow. You won't get radio play because it's got a first few seconds. Yeah, yeah. But it's Whitney. Yeah. And if you, I mean, I've got goosebumps. Yeah. If you listen to those first few lines, oh my It's just jaw-dropping performance. Yeah, it is. It really is.
Okay. So we've been talking about Whitney Houston here on our pop culture segment, and we'll go out with Where Do Broken Hearts Go?, one of Whitney Houston's greatest songs. Do check out the Whitney Houston documentary on Netflix here in Singapore.
The only things I learned is that I need